Hey everyone, this is Hope. On this week's episode of Risk, we are going to hear from Emerson Dameron, specifically some life hacks like this.
Get a length of green dental floss, like about this long. It should be green. Tie one end of it around one of your front teeth. And if anybody acts like there's something weird going on, they are the one with the problem.
That and more. But first, do you have a story that would work well on one of our winter holiday episodes? Funny, strange, or even terrible memories from Hanukkah, Christmas, New Year's, or any other end-of-year festivities? It's crazy to think about, but we're already talking about episode lineups for that time of year. So pitch us your story anytime at risk-show.com/submissions.
We'll be right back.
Folks, when my father was diagnosed with cancer in 2005, the prognosis at that time was that he might have about a year to live. Well, he beat that cancer, and we had 15 more wonderful, joyous years with my father. Years he got to spend with his grandchildren while they were growing up. We were so grateful for the support that we got from the medical community and all of that. Well, listen, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society does such invaluable work. Blood cancer makes up 40% of pediatric and young adult cancers, including leukemia and lymphoma, and 80% of these survivors have lifelong side effects from their treatment. Young adults with blood cancer need support made just for them, to help them live better, live longer. LLS, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, offers free support, resources, and connection to peer survivors. If you or someone you know has been diagnosed with blood cancer, contact LLS online at lls.org/support-resources or by calling 800-955-4572 today.
Now here's the show. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Hope, one of the producers here behind the scenes at Risk, and I'll be taking the reins from Kevin this week. This is one of my all-time favorites, Andy Schaaf, behind me now. We're going to go on a journey this week, just like Emerson Dameron and Alicia Brophy are about to tell us in their stories. And you actually have a chance to go on a journey as well with Risk's own Kevin Allison, our business director, JC Cassis, and a bunch of other Risk fans when the big Risk trip to Portugal happens next year in May. See the sights, share wonderful meals, and get in on the story sharing by going to risk-show.com/Portugal to join us on our 15th anniversary celebration. Then maybe you'll have a story from that trip to share on the podcast. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Emerson Dameron. But before that, we're going to start with a story from Alicia Brophy. She told this story back in 2022 in Los Angeles, and it is a wild ride. So here's Alicia with a story we're calling Naked and Afraid.
If this ends up on the internet, my mother will find it. So, Mom, if you're listening, turn it off now. If you're still listening, you can never bring this up to me, and you cannot tell my aunts. So I grew up with a father who is a quadriplegic. He has a disease that's very similar to muscular dystrophy, And so it was gradual. It started when he was 32. And it meant that my childhood, I watched as he slowly lost his ability to do things. So he no longer could drive, and then slowly no longer could walk, and then eventually could no longer hold things. And he's now confined to an electric wheelchair that he controls with his chin. And travel for him now is like if he can get the medical van to take him somewhere for a couple hours. And when I was 17, I Googled his disease. And I found out that it's genetic. And I suddenly have a ticking clock. I know that when I turn 32, I'm going to lose my hands and my feet. And so I tell no one, but I get obsessed with this idea that I have to live an entire lifetime in my 20s. Because when I turn 32, it's over for me. And I'm from a really small town. There's no real opportunities. There's no adventure. So I do the only thing I can think of. I just start to make lists. And it's like a bucket list, but instead of like things to do before you die, it's things to do before you lose your hands and feet. And on this list were things like bungee jumping, skydiving, falling in love, traveling a foreign country. All things that someday I could look back on and be like, huh, I really did that. At 21, I had done none of it. I was living in a border town, working at a GNC, stacking vitamins, working minimum wage in some mall. And I was so excited when these two girls, we'll call them Betty and Jessica, they were baristas at the little coffee stand in the mall. They invite me to go with them to Mexico for a vacation. And Betty's husband was paying for the motel room, so I have a free place to stay. And I'm like, oh, foreign country. I can check this off my list. I'm so excited. We go down, and the first day, I guess I should set the stage. This is maybe the late 90s, maybe the early 2000s. There's going to be a lot of maybes. I'm not going to give any specific details. You will know why shortly. So we're in some unnamed town in Mexico. And we're walking down the main strip, and there's a lot of, like, spring break-type clubs. And as we're going along, this guy comes up behind us, and he's, like, a real fast talker. He's a local. He says his name's Pancho. And Pancho's trying to get us to go to his club. And he's like, yeah, we got an oceanfront view, and we've got a foam pit for the foam dance parties. It's like, every club here has all of those things. He's like, we've got bungee jumping. Okay. That's on the list. I have to do this. But it was like $80. And at this age, I don't even have a credit card yet. The cash I have is enough for some street tacos. Like, I have no way of coming up with this money. But I also know that, like, I have to do it, right? This is my opportunity. In a decade, nothing like this is an option anyway. I got to do it. And so just out of desperation, I say, yeah, but the bungee jumping's free. If I do it naked, the answer, guys, is always yes. So we make a little deal, and my friends think I am an idiot, and I think I'm so smart because I've agreed to do this jump while the club is closed. So who's really gonna know? Like my two girlfriends and Pancho, it's fine. So we go, get to the club, and like I said, it's closed. So we go in, it's just this big, expansive, empty space. And there's a bunch of workers buzzing around in neon blue shirts. And in the center of the room is this round table full of businessmen. And they are gorging on a seafood feast. And Pancho introduces me to the mayor. He also introduces me to some other, like, politicians and figureheads and some businessmen. And it's not said what their trade is. But each man at this table has standing behind them their own armed security guards. And I got a little curious when I decided I was going to tell this story tonight. I was kind of curious, like, where everyone ended up in this story. I did a little sleuthing, and Pancho and this club and that mayor are all mentioned in legal allegations for things that involve trafficking of substances and executions. So this is why we're being real vague, guys. So these are my new friends, and Pancho told these guys about our little deal, so they're gonna stick around for the naked bungee jumping. So we go out the side door to this patio area, and there's this big crane, and this is where I first lay eyes on Bungee Boy. And he's just this guy, he's like in his early 20s, he's American, this is his summer job. He's got a real boy next door vibe. And we make eye contact, and it's like, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. He's really cute. And he's explaining how the whole thing works, and he's really charming, and I now have to strip down naked in front of him. Also, I recognize that right now you have all the same questions that I have, which is like, well, how does this work? Because you're naked, there's like not a lot to offer, and there's probably like hooks. And it turns out you can be fully naked, and they can still strap in your ankles. So he takes me over to this like metal cage, and he has me sit in this plastic patio chair, and he gets down on one knee, and he's being so respectful, guys. He's like keeping his eyes lower, and he's cuffing my ankles in. And as this metal cage is raising, we're making small talk, totally pretending like all of this is super normal. And as we get higher and higher, I have a better vantage. And I can now see hundreds of club kids standing outside of this club. Because that whole time that we've been inside with the seafood feast, these club kids had started to line up waiting for the club to open. And they see this crane cage thing coming up over them, and they're all like, what's that? And then they're getting glimpses of me, and they're cheering, and disposable cameras are getting pulled out. So I'm up there, and I'm on the ledge, and like the whole deal had been, well, I'm going to jump in front of my girlfriends and Pancho, but now we've added hundreds of club kids, disposable cameras, businessmen, and the mayor. But the truth is, I'm actually so terrified of the jump and stepping off that ledge that I'm not even really thinking about the naked part anymore. I'm just really scared. And Bungee Boy, he's so sweet, and he's like whispering all these affirmations, and he's like, you're so brave. You can do this. You can do anything. You've got this. And it's like, yeah, Bungee Boy, we've got a connection. Like, he's not going to let me get killed. So I go ahead and I lean forward, and I fall over the crowd. And wind is whooshing in places nature never intended. And I finally hit the end of that cord, and I'm bouncing. And some of me is bouncing more than others. And then I'm finally just hanging. So that's the thing with bungee jumping. They don't tell you. There's like a long period where you're just hanging. So I finally get brought down. And I've really won the admiration of Pancho. And Pancho is a very powerful man. Everyone around him is just always kissing the ring. And we're now treated like royalty. Anything we want, free booze, free food, free professional massages, which had not been on my bucket list, but should have been. And Pancho has taken a liking to me. And so he's just gifting us anything he can to keep us around. He's even trying to get us to stay in the hotel he owns, because Pancho doesn't work at this nightclub, right? Pancho owns this nightclub, and he owns half of the town. And I tell my girlfriends, like, no, we cannot stay somewhere he has a key. But we do take Pancho up on a lot of the other offerings. Thing is, what I'm most interested in is Bungee Boy. And the truth is, Pancho doesn't really have the right to like me, because one of the employees lets it slip, Pancho is married. And this explains why sometimes this one specific lady shows up. Pancho sends us off on four-wheeling adventures down the beach, which I'm like, great, I get to check four-wheeling adventure off my list. Bungee Boy and I, we finally have like our first kiss behind the club. And he's like, no one can know about this. And I'm like, yeah, but really, like, Pancho's married. It's not fair if he likes me. And he's like, oh, no, no, you don't understand. And then he reveals a bunch more information, and I realize I have now cast myself as the main role in a telenovela. Because Pancho's married. Pancho also has a girlfriend. Pancho's girlfriend likes Bungee Boy. And Pancho's girlfriend, he's like, yeah, she made a pass at me. I didn't go for it. It's been really awkward. Pancho's kind of sensing what's up, and he has been making the entire summer just hell for me. And so it's like, oh, okay. I can't also come along and snub Pancho for Bungee Boy. And everyone at this club is always warning me. I'm like, you better not be hanging with Bungee Boy. Better not see you with Bungee Boy. So I don't have much choice in the matter. I have to continue to accept the lovely hospitality that Pancho is offering and secretly sneak around with Bungee Boy. And so Bungee Boy and I, we are passing secret messages and everything, and we make plans to have a romantic dinner. And my girlfriends are going to cover for me. And so we have like one specific street we're going to meet at. And so he goes on his dinner break. I wake like 10 minutes. I lie and say I need to go get stuff out of my hotel room. And we meet up. And I'm so giddy. I've got butterflies. And we're holding hands. We're going down the street. And there's like a real freedom, you know, and just like the two of us finally. And it's really feeling like something more. And it's like, oh my gosh, is this another thing I'm going to check off my list? Like I'm falling in love. And plus, he's already seen me naked, so we're like halfway to our relationship. And so we're going along, and suddenly we're passing this trinket stand. He grabs me and he shoves me. And he throws me in an alley and then shoves me behind a dumpster. And I'm so scared. He's being so rough with me, and I don't know what's happening, and it's just the two of us. And I'm terrified, and that's when I see two neon blue shirts pass by. Pancho had me followed. So now Bungee Boy, forget romantic dinner, Bungee Boy is really, truly terrified. Apparently there had been some threats made in the past. And remember how I said I got a little curious where everyone ended up? I just learned that a couple years ago, Pancho ran over one of his employees, forwards and backwards, and then took off on one of those four-wheelers that he was always offering us. So Bungee Boy is truly terrified. He's like, you stay here. I'm going to run back, see if I can get there before Pancho learns of this. He takes off, and now I'm just in an alley behind a dumpster somewhere in Mexico by myself, and I can hear the sounds of like everyone else like partying and having a good time, and they have no idea what's happening in this alley. And you know, I'm thinking about it, and I don't really know what to do, but I start thinking, like, well, maybe I can go back and, like, smooth things over with Pancho. Maybe I can fix this. So I start to walk back to the club. And before I make it to the club, Betty and Jessica cut me off. They have a taxi running. They had been at the club, and they're like, look, we were there. Pancho knows everything. Bungee Boy took off into the night. He's hiding. No one knows where he is. We just cleared up the hotel. Everything's in the back of this taxi. Get in. We got to go. We got to get out of this town. We got to get out of this country. So I get in the taxi, and Betty gets in the taxi, and it's actually Jessica who pauses. And she says to us, guys, look, I actually really love it here. And yeah, all the scary stuff that's happening, it's kind of your problem. And I met a guy too, and I don't have anything to go back to, like a barista job at the mall that I hate. I want to stay here, start over here. And we're like, no, 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 like that's not actually an option. You have to get in this taxi and leave with us. She's not budging. And then we see neon blue shirts coming. And it's like, well, I'm already leaving him. I guess we're leaving Jessica too. And so Betty and I get in that taxi, and we leave Jessica behind. And we head to the border, cross the border, and by that night, I'm just back to my old safe life, as if nothing had happened. and I have to go back to shifts at GNC. It's a little different. Jessica isn't at the coffee stand anymore. I'm back, I'm stacking my vitamins, and I'm thinking about everybody because I don't have answers. I don't know what happened after I left. And then after about a week, Jessica rolls in my store, and right behind her is Bungee Boy. He'd been in hiding. He eventually found her and begged her to help him get back across the border. He's got no money, he's got no belongings, and she just dumps him here because she's like, you're Bungee Boy, your problem. And in the harsh fluorescent lights of a GNC, he's just some guy, you know? He's just a kid on the run from the Mexican mob, hiding in my vitamin store, hoping that his dad buys him a plane ticket home. And so I help him, you know, get in touch with his family and get to an airport and the whole thing. And he goes off and we never talk again. It's a couple years later, and I am in college now, and I'm in the dorms, and a bunch of my little dorm friends, it's their first spring break ever, and they decide they're going to go to that town. And they invite me, and I say, oh, no, 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 you don't understand. I'm not allowed in that town. And they listen to my story, and they laugh it off, and they're like, Alicia, that was years ago. Jimmy, thousands of tourists go through every weekend, like bygones be bygones. And they're like, look, if it'll make you feel better, we won't go to that particular club and we won't stay at that hotel he owns. And I decide, okay, you know what? You're right. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. So I go. And it is fine. We go out that first night. We're going to these other clubs. And it's about 3-4 in the morning. And I am enjoying a street taco. And a man in a neon blue shirt comes walking by. And he slows down, and then he stops. And under the street light, he takes a real good look at me. And he points, and he says, huh, I know who you are. And I drop my taco into that dirt, and I bolt. And I run as fast as I can, literally across town, through people. My friends have no idea what's going on. They literally just see me fleeing. And I ran all the way across town, up all the flights of stairs, and I get back to our motel room, and I lock myself in. And the rest of the trip, my friends, they go clubbing, and they go out, and they have a good time. And I stay inside, where I can just watch the telenovelas. Just want to end with this. I am now an undisclosed number of years over 32, and I'm healthy. I have my hands, I have my feet, and I also have a very long list of things that I can look back on and be like, oh, I really did that. Thank you.
This is Banda El Recodo behind me now, and we just heard from Alicia Brophy. That is truly a journey of a story, and I've got to say, I respect how quickly she thought to offer the idea of naked bungee jumping as a way to save money. That's the kind of girl math I can get behind, and I might have to bookmark that idea for the future. Alicia has quite the impressive resume. She's a Moth Grand Slam champion and is an Academy Nickel Fellow. In her bio, she mentions that alongside her co-writer Scott Miles, she wrote on Netflix's Inside Job and developed a TV show with Kevin Hart for Disney+. She also says that she's currently somewhere in the Canadian wilderness working on an upcoming episode of Showtime's Yellowjackets. You can find more info at brophyandmiles.com.
We'll be right back.
What's better than watching your team win? Winning money while you do it. I'm Jim Costa, and on Cash the Ticket, Mike Valenti and I give you the edge to make every game playable. College football, NFL, we're breaking it all down game by game. Your podcast feed is going to be filled, and you're going to love it. You can click on the games you care about. We do it all. With our analysis, we're finding games that other people aren't talking about. We're turning every Saturday and every Sunday into days where you got a chance to win. Don't just sit on the sidelines. Cash the Ticket with us. Follow Cash the Ticket in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back.
If you're the type of person who's into bonus content and you haven't already checked out our Patreon page, you are honestly missing out. When I first discovered Risk many years ago, I binged so many episodes in such a short amount of time. It's actually embarrassing. If I had known about the Patreon page as well, ooh, man. Anyways, this week we've got a story about a punk band told by Nicole Georges. Here's a little preview of what that sounds like.
But I was like, oh, he really likes me. And he would call me like his future wife in these letters. And I was like, oh my God, because I was 20. So I didn't know if a stranger tells you you're their future wife, it means they have bad boundaries. It doesn't mean that you're their future wife. And my boundaries were such that I was like, I'm getting married, I guess.
That will be out soon, so go check it out. Next, we're going to hear from Emerson Dameron. He told the story live in LA in April of this year, and I was in the audience and I remember loving it. So I hope you do too. Here's Emerson Dameron with a story we're calling Spider Says.
I have had for most of my life two burning desires in my heart. I have longed desperately to connect with other human beings on a profound, ineffable level of intimacy. And I've desperately wanted to be left alone. In the summer of my junior year of college, I was getting a lot of the second thing. My car was broken down and I was not drinking, which was an excellent thing for me to be not doing. I was a 22-year-old college student with the drinking problem of a 40-something divorcee. But it was in Athens, Georgia, which as I understood the culture of the city, if you didn't have a car and you didn't drink, that foreclosed on any possible social life that you could have. So I spent a lot of time alone in my apartment. I was drinking a lot of coffee because I had to do something because human consciousness itself is hell. So at first I thought I might be hallucinating when I was watching a spider building a web in the corner of the ceiling, which it had been doing for the better part of a week. And I'd been watching the whole thing evolve. And I just got this unmistakable sense that the spider was trying to communicate something to me through the weaving of the tapestry. And I thought, that seems implausible. I was skeptical initially, but then something deep in my heart started interrogating my skepticism, and much in the way that people describe their religious conversions. It was a leap of faith, but it made more sense to believe. It was more ridiculous to not believe that the spider was telling me that I needed to go to Portland, Oregon. I said, well, like, buy a plane ticket? And the spider said, no, you need to see America at grade in a motor vehicle. I said, are you sure you're not thinking of Portland, Maine? He said, no, I'm not a fucking idiot. Well, I don't have a car. How am I going to do this? And then in the distance, I heard barking dogs. And I knew in that moment that my only option was to take the only form of transportation that I could reasonably afford, which was a Greyhound bus. And I had a plan for this trip. Because it's very important riding Greyhound bus to have two seats as much as possible. There were a couple of reasons that mattered. One is, as I learned on the first day of kindergarten, I am surrounded by enemies. Also, I needed somewhere to slump to experience the hypnagogic states that sort of kind of pass for sleep on Greyhound bus, which I was on for almost an entire week from east to west. We were making all the stops. At one point, the bus driver stopped in Cincinnati and pulled out into some neighborhood and stopped the bus and got out and started asking people for directions. And that's when I realized that the world's not out to get us. And if it is, it wouldn't be able to get its shit together to do that. The problem is incompetence to a degree indistinguishable from malice. But I managed to keep two seats all the way to Chicago, and here's how. You can use this. I recommend it. Get a length of green dental floss, about this long. It should be green. Tie one end of it around one of your front teeth and just let it hang there. And just mind your own business. And if anybody acts like there's something weird going on, they are the one with the problem. I had two seats to myself all the way to Chicago. And then as the bus continued through a number of large squarish states, I still had the two seats. And I was also starting to realize something that I've always known in my heart. I was learning what I already knew, which is that life is just worthless bullshit. All of it. It's nothing but bombed out gas stations and corn. And the rest of it is worthless too, because I've realized Santa Claus was bullshit, the dominoes kind of fell from there, and I just stopped believing in anything. I put stuff in my letters to Santa that my parents were not supposed to read. Would you ever trust anybody again? So what did I do on the bus ride? Relaxed into nihilism. I wrote a lot. I filled up several notebooks. What else does one do? Oh, I think I meditated by accident at one point. I didn't know how to do it. I just did it because I'd run out of other shit to do. And because I wanted to declare war on my consciousness. I just thought this was the worst possible idea. Fuck that spider. And it kept getting worse, because when we got into a town called Rock Springs, Wyoming, I realized that my luck had run out, because there was a long line of people waiting to get on the bus there, because I guess one of the things to do in Rock Springs is get the fuck out of Rock Springs. And I realized it was going to be standing room only, which is they overbook Greyhound, which is against the Geneva Conventions, or should be. But I was definitely going to lose my seat. And I was like, okay, yeah, now this is hell, and it's going to be like this from now on. And I just I leaned over, and I was halfway looking out the window. I wouldn't say half asleep, but I didn't really exist at that point, I don't think. And then all of a sudden, the desire to connect with human beings became ascendant, because weird shit happens when you've been on a bus awake for 3 or 4 days. And so I looked over at my new traveling companion, and I was surprised to find that she was knockout gorgeous. Kind of dirty blonde hair with this Debbie Harry edginess, but then an elegance, but she'd seen some shit, obviously. There was a soulfulness there, but the elegance had endured, which made it all the more a sign of strength. I don't have a type, but she was it. And what was further shocking to me was that we immediately hit it off. We just started talking. I'm not sure who started it. But like, after a while, it was no one was leading the dance. We were just dancing. And it was like running into somebody that I'd known years and years ago and just falling right back into the same conversation. You know, there was no catch up. It was just, we just picked up where we left off in whatever other lifetime it was. She was on her way to Phoenix, and I asked her, "Well, what awaits you in Phoenix?" She said, "My ex-boyfriend lives there." I said, "Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I'm glad you're laying it down for love and giving that another chance." And she said, "No, it's not love. It's hate. He's an abusive piece of shit. But do you think it's a good idea to go to Phoenix to see him?" "I'm not going to see him, but I am going to slash his tires." I thought, you know, that's not how I deal with conflict, but respect. Not only do you have fire in the belly, but you've made a plan and you're executing on it, right? At no small inconvenience or expense. And she said, "Well, why are you riding Greyhound from Georgia to Oregon?" And my first thought was I was bored. But then I thought, you know, I'm just going to tell her about the spider. I was advised by a spider that lives in my apartment that this was a good idea, and I couldn't say no to that. "So you have a spider that lives in your apartment?" I said, "Fuck yes, I do. I'd never kill spiders when I see them because they kill other things that I like a lot less. And I'm pretty sure spiders like me because I've never been bitten or attacked by one. And 90% of spiders are in the brown recluse category. And they hunt humans for fun. But they've always liked me. So like, I've got it like that with the spiders. In fact, if you really want to fuck up this dude's life, like, I'll get the spiders to go down there and work him over." And I thought, wait, are we flirting? Like, is that what's going on? Because if I think that there are sparks or chemistry happening, it's almost guaranteed to be happening because I am fucking oblivious. Like, I like love bombing because that's pretty much the only way to get through to me. I think most of my long-term relationships start with kidnapping and then get more intense from there. If I think there's sexual tension in the air and I'm involved, that's a pretty good indication that it's happening. I think there's a probability greater than zero that we could have hooked up in the bathroom of the bus. And I don't think we would have set a precedent there. I think other people would probably done it on that trip. But there's never a perfect time to ask that question. And my sense is that there was a window that opened and closed. And in what seemed like no time at all, we rolled into Salt Lake City, where I was going to stay on this bus and go up to Boise, and she was going to get on another bus going to Phoenix. And I just realized, you know, this is perfect as it is. It has to be. Like, these little, like, flirtations in the elevator and friends shaking hands saying, "How do you do?" is intimacy in its purest form. Anything after that gets complicated. Like, to F the ineffable with somebody with no expectations, because this was before Friendster and we weren't going to be pen pals. It wasn't really that kind of thing. That is a beautiful experience, and I had to come all the way out here to have it. Thank you, Spider. And now I've got my two seats back. And I'm exhausted because I get drained from human interaction. And I also feel really good, which is unusual. And before I slouch back over, I catch a look at myself in the reflection for the first time in a while. And I look fucking deranged. My hair is out everywhere. I look like a mugshot. And I still have that dental floss. Thanks.
Riding on a Greyhound bus to my seem to come. I hear your voice, see your face. I don't know where it's coming from. Voices on the wind, ringing in my mind. People passing by, I think they don't know why.
This is Eric Clapton behind me now, and we just heard from Emerson Dameron. Emerson is actually the host of his own show, Medicated Minutes. Now, what are Medicated Minutes, you ask? My curiosity was piqued, so I checked out his website, medicatedminutes.com, and I think this is one of the best descriptions I've ever read. LA's number one avant-garde personal development program, experimental storytelling and comedy, power, drugs, and mental health, the home of Ask a Sadist, bite-sized erotic thrillers, and the first church of the Satanic Buddha. There you have it, folks. You can find Emerson on the socials at Emerson Dameron. All right, you know the drill. Today is the day, so take a risk. Dreams I spend.